This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 173. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
020-8816-791.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Welcome to the show, Gareth. Welcome to the show, Berners.
Hello. Hey, Coach. You all right?
Yes, I'm good. I'm ready for another podcast, ready to find out what everybody's been up to in the last week. Gareth, are you still entrenched in holiday mode?
No, not too much. Actually, I've been doing quite a lot of coaching. I've got some coaching going on this afternoon, which is I'm looking forward to, weather permitting. I'm going to go and watch Somerset Seconds play a little bit this afternoon. And I've taken in a couple of festivals this week, taking the dog down and watched some under-13s cricket, which has been really good as well.
Excellent. Anything you've spotted there? Any notes you've taken while you've been wandering around looking at a bit of cricket?
It's always good, isn't it, to go to festivals, I think, you know, especially ones where there's a brilliant festival here in Somerset. King's just up the road from me, and you get sort of eight teams in walking distance of each other, so you can get a good feel of where people are at, really, and where players are at. And as opposed to, you know, when you're watching one game of cricket, you've only got 22 on show, but you can see it over a number of fields. I think it really helps to get people to stand out and gives you a bit of a reference point about where they are with their cricket as well.
I thought you were talking about music for a while there, Gareth. I thought you might have been attending Glastonbury. That's down your neck of the woods, isn't it?
It is. It's not far away. It's just up the road from school.
Talking about that Taunton Festival, I played in that many moons ago for Devon.
Did you? Yeah,
it was really good actually, because I was playing for Devon, obviously, and you know, you'd come up against your Surreys and your Middlesex, and when you're 12, that's quite a. It was always quite a daunting challenge, because you always used to think, "Oh God, you know, they've got massive pools of players and all the famous players that came out of there," but then when you kind of all mixed it up out in the middle, it actually, you know, more times than not at that particular festival, it would be one of the minor counties at youth level that would often be quite successful. Your Cornwalls or your Wiltshires or someone like that, who would have, only takes one or two good players, like scoring 100 at that level is really something, isn't it? So,
oh, massive. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I think back when I played junior cricket, I didn't score my first 100 until I was just shy of my 15th birthday. And, you know, I've been down there a couple of times, down to those sort of festivals in the last few years. And you're seeing people getting, you know, not just little hundreds, but getting those daddy ones that Graham Gooch talks about. And that's an amazing effort at the age of 12, 13 to be scoring those sort of runs.
We were talking about spinners there, and at the other end of the scale, those are people coming through. The other end of the scale, we've got an article this week all about Harbhajan and how he's sort of completely gone downhill in recent times. There was a lot of stats in the article, and there was a little bit of conjecture as to why that might have happened. But it's an interesting story, Harbhajan, and I think it's probably one that's reflected a lot when it comes to spin bowlers. Someone who seemingly has a lot of talent and has done very well, and then seemingly overnight seems to just lose it. It's probably more complex than that. But Gareth, have you seen that? Have you seen spinners who are stratospheric and then suddenly they just seem to lose that magic touch?
Well, I wouldn't go stratospheric. I think he obviously is the main example, because he's in the public eye, because he plays cricket in India, and because he had such a sensational start to his international career. And when I say starting, I mean the first sort of 3-4 years of his career, he was picking up wickets in all formats of the game and was really the guy to watch. The interesting thing about spin generally is, as a general rule, people mature quite late. But if you track the success of spinners, they tended to have an early peak, then plateau a little bit, and then come back. So somebody like Monty Panesar, potentially, if he keeps developing and continuing his development over the next couple of years, could be somebody who follows that graph. But yeah, normally you'd be coming into his peak, wouldn't he, Harbhajan? But I think it's difficult for him to go again and to reach that dizzy height because it was such a dizzy height, and maybe his expectation of himself and all of the things that get built up around him have contributed to him not being able to sustain it and not to being able to develop, because he is somebody who, as a character, is quite feisty and quite fiery, and although he's very civil off of the pitch, he's toes the line, as we know, when he's on the pitch. And he probably puts himself up there for going through dips in form, and not always being able to sort of rationalise why that would happen. I don't know too much about him, but I should imagine he's not all that easy to coach. It's sad to see him really trying to travel the world, trying to rediscover what he had, which was fantastic flight, really good ability to get the ball to dip on the batter. I think that was his crucial part of his game, and obviously an ability to spin the ball. And from watching him, admittedly, in one day cricket over the last couple of weeks, a few times on the television over here playing for Essex, that ability to flight the ball and to get it to dip has definitely gone, and he's become quite flattened. And as a result, his wicket taking, which was his mainstay when he first came into the game, has dropped a bit.
He's quite interesting as well, isn't he? Because he's one of those guys that's brought kind of some elusive kind of controversies to himself with the way he behaves on the field, and also people saying he chucks it and stuff like that. So I think that's got quite a big bearing on one's performance as well, hasn't it? Like his reputation, or you know, based around other things by other teams, it you know, kind of is more preferred than his actual bowling. Like, okay, Harbhajan's coming today, right, great, let's wind him up. Not, oh, hang on a minute, he's changed his trajectory and he's not turning it so much. They're probably least worried about his actual cricketing credentials.
Yeah, but I think absolutely is that they've gone towards his character, and you know, he is somebody who you can wind up, and his performance can be affected by it. There's no doubt in that. I've also seen it work the other way as well, where he's got wound up and actually done quite well. So, you know, he's a volatile character. You know, ultimately, if I was anything to do with Harbhajan, I'm sure he wouldn't listen anyway, but I would say get your off-spinner working as well as you possibly can. Don't worry about what the Indian media are saying, because you can probably dictate what the Indian media say by putting in some performances based around getting your off-spinner working well.
It's often interesting with spinners as well, isn't it, how they seem to kind of try to evolve. Like, look at a lot of the kind of what I call bulk standard off-spinners or left-arm orthodox spinners around the world that have played in the last decade. You know, you could name them, you know, like Monty, you've got James Treadwell, you've got the guy Botha who played for South Africa, and Van der Merwe. You know, these guys, their span playing at the top is very limited because they get worked out. So it's very interesting that point you made there, that, okay, sometimes it's good to kind of try and penetrate things and evolve with the times and change what you're trying to do. But looking at Graham Swann, he just does that core thing over and over again. And okay, people know what he's going to do, but it's still good enough to get them out. And I think that's a nice thing that kind of levitates Shane Warne again from the rest of the pack, is that he was that good that people could never work him out. And there is no one really on the circuit at the moment, spinning wise, that's in that same genre, because these spinners, they come in, they'll play a series, they'll play a couple of one dayers, they'll go the distance, and then they'll think, he's not really quite at the races against this pack of lines.
And it's a really good point you make about Warne, because actually he had more variation at the beginning of his career than he had towards the end of his career. And because his shoulder got injured, he wasn't able to bowl his googly on such a regular basis, which was a massive... I can remember when England went out there and none of the batters could pick his googly, and if they could, David Boone was just taking catch after catch at short leg off of it. And that went, and so he had to really master his leg spin. And he always used to say that he had three different types of leg spinner, and the only difference between those three different types of leg spinners was the pace in which it was getting to the pitch. Now, that's just variation. That's still your leg spinner, and mastering being able to bowl it at three different paces. That's, you know, not trying to create a ball that spins both ways or whatever the case may be. And ultimately, the guys who will sustain themselves as long as possible now in international cricket will be the guys that are the most consistent and have the most skill around the one or two core elements or one or two core deliveries that they've got. And you know, mystery doesn't stay very long in this modern world with cameras and simulators and all of that sort of thing. So you have to be good at what you do.
Just to wrap this little section up, something that a guest on this show, friend of Pitch Vision Academy, said once on the show, Menno Gazendam, was that spinner is a little bit of a misnomer of a name for these guys, because spin is just one thing. Spin off the pitch is just one thing that they do.
Yeah, it is.
Really, if you call yourself a spinner and you're just thinking about the deviation off the pitch, you're not thinking about all the tools that are available to you, dip and flight, pace of the ball, all those different areas which you don't necessarily think about if you're just thinking, I'm just going to turn the ball off the pitch. So I think, just to finish this little section off, it's important to say to any sort of young spinner out there, don't necessarily just think of yourself as a spinner. You've got a lot more tools available to you. So
it's true. I'm just going to add a bit onto that, though, Warney's coach, Terry Jenner, who's sadly not with us anymore, he always used to talk about spin is in the air and break is off of the pitch. And when he said that, he meant that the important thing was the spin in the air, because the spin in the air and the rotations on the ball and the angle of the seam and all of that would actually create dip. It would create movement of a ball in the air, drift of a ball in the air, and obviously would give it the ball the best chance of breaking off of a pitch. So I think, you know, allying those two views together gives you an example of how many different tools you can have as a spinner, yet the number of tools that you have as a spinner are pretty much down to how you spin the ball in the air.
Okay, great. So let's wrap up the section now with our usual yes-no round. Three questions read out by Berners, and we are only allowed to say yes or no, despite how much we want to go into a bit more detail. So, Berners, over to you for this week's yes-no round.
First question. County cricket is the best breeding ground in the world for test players.
Yes.
No.
Second question. Bad weather makes school and club cricket in the UK worse than other test countries.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question. Kevin Peterson should play in the Big Bash.
No.
No.
Right, so let's have a look at this week's questions. As always, every week we have a dip into the mailbag and find out exactly what's going on with our listeners and what kind of problems that they're having. The best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Berners, what are the questions that we've got this week that are going in for the competition?
Our first question's in from Varun, and he's just been promoted to his inter-districts club captain, and he just wants to know what kind of pitches these will be played on, and whether he should elect to bat or bowl first. So I'm not entirely sure which country that inter-district is in, but maybe you guys can give him a bit of feedback about batting or bowling first.
Well, the way I read this question was that he was more asking generally about what you would do on different types of pitches, because, as you said, Berners, we don't really know what type of pitches he's going to be playing on. So I thought maybe we could just have a little chat about different types of pitches and what a captain would think about doing when he turns up and has a little look and decides what's going on. So I think the key thing to remember when you're thinking about pitches is that very often you can be wrong. If the experts get it wrong more often than not, then as a captain who's playing at an amateur level, will probably get it wrong as well. So I wouldn't put too much into what the pitch is going to be like, because there is a chance that you could be wrong. But there are some general principles that you can follow.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't overstate the role of a pitch, and you know, there's other things that come into consideration, and one of them is your preference as a team, because I've never met a team that you would say were completely 50-50 whether they're better bowling first or batting first. There will be a preference which way round they play the game, and you know, the people that you've got at your disposal would dictate which one that is. So I would get to know your team more than I would get to know pitches. I think that's a really a valid point. But you know, one of the things that we got taught in county cricket was that you, in longer format cricket, you'd always have a bat first, because the pitches generally are at their best at the start of the game. Now that doesn't always apply in cricket that doesn't have, you know, full-time groundsmen and covers. Yet it's a pretty sound principle, and generally, if you go in with that idea and you look at a pitch, and something tells you about that pitch that isn't the right way to go, and you actually should bowl first, it would have to be a fairly startling reason to do it. So that was always the way that we got brought up in county cricket. It was you bat first, unless there was some real startling reason, i.e., you know, the grass was 5 inches long and the weather forecast was overcast for the first day, and blaring sun for the next three, and obviously you then look at bowling first. But that was a general principle. But as I say, I think it's more important that you get to know your team and which way they want to play the game, and how to get the best out of those as a captain. You know, that it's people that win your games of cricket, not pitches.
Yeah, and of course there's the famous saying of W.G. Grace, which I know is probably going back quite a long way, but it's quite a good saying, which is bat first, unless you feel like conditions are conducive to bowling, then think about it, and then bat first.
Yeah, well, I that's pretty much the way that we got brought up to do it. And if you are going to bowl first in Championship cricket, we would always say that we would need to have the opposition four down as a minimum at lunch for it to be justified. And that's not always easy. In 50-over cricket, you're probably looking at getting a team four down in the first 15 overs would probably be your guide to that. Otherwise, you'd be looking to bat first. So, my preference would be to bat first. However, I'd look at my team. So an example this year was at the start of the year for Millfield School, we had a very strong bowling side. So we would look to put our best element of our game out there first. So we look to bowl first in as many of the conditions as we possibly could. As the confidence of our batters increased, and probably the pitches got better as the summer went on, we would look to bat first. But certainly at the beginning, we had a strong preference for bowling first. We did that and with a lot of success. And as that confidence grew in the team, we were able to do it both batting first and bowling first. So, but that was down to the people at my disposal as a coach and at Matt Hopper as the captain. And those were decisions that we made. But so it was very people based.
There is a statistical report. I can't remember what it was. I wrote about it on Pitch Vision Academy. I'll dig it out. That said that generally in one day cricket, it's slightly better to statistically it's slightly better to chase in day games, because you know what the target is. So their conjecture was, you know what the target is. So therefore you can. You can go ahead and win. Whereas if you're setting a target, you don't necessarily know what a good target is. So, as well as if there is actually a target there. So there is a case as well for saying if you're playing limited over format that you want to default to thinking about chasing first unless there's an argument to go otherwise. But I mean, as you can tell, there's no. The fact that we're discussing this and not coming into any specific conclusions probably tells you everything that you need to know. There aren't any hard and fast rules when it comes to deciding what to do with the pitch, unless it's a real, unless it's an absolutely awful pitch, you're going to bowl them out for 25.
Yeah.
Then, you probably, you're always just weighing up the options and then taking your best educated guess, aren't you, really?
Exactly.
In our league, the decision is often based upon the structure of the game, because if you, we like to control the game and go for the win. If we end up batting first, more times than not, we're there with 20 overs to go and they're shutting up shop just playing for the draw, because they know that they're never going to really chase what we set, just because in terms of our strength and depth as a club. So it's like, our toss is never actually based on the actual pitch whatsoever. It's based on who we're playing against and who we've got in our side.
It's funny that you say about controlling the game by batting second, Bernice, because certainly when I was growing up playing club cricket, when it was a lot more based on declarations, the control of the game would be batting first, because you've got the control of the declaration then, and you can decide when to pull out and when that's going to be the right time to pull out and then give them that carrot to keep going for it in order to bowl them out. Risk losing in order to win. That was always the sort of the attacking captaincy style of that time. I mean, that's changed a lot now. Although, you know, the cricket that I play now, draws are still possible because it's the point system is very much geared towards winning and losing draws, and you get a lot more points for having a winning draw than you do for a losing draw, and you know teams are less likely to not go for it, if you see what I mean. So it's changed a bit now, but yeah, it used to be that you control the game by batting first because A, you put the runs on the board, and B, you can decide when that innings finishes and how long you need to bowl them out and how many runs you need on the board.
Oh, if I'm captain in declaration, we don't let them bat.
That's the spirit.
Oh no, you don't let them bat.
Back to an hour after tea.
I don't care about winning that much. We'll have a bat, thanks, and we'll bat, and we'll finish about 7 o'clock, and then we'll have a beer. That's great.
Oh, that's the spirit of playing club game. See, I'm the opposite. I'm looking to declare about 10 minutes before tea. Go on there, boys, in you go.
That's because you're a keeper and you've got ADT. Next question comes in from Vijay, and he's a coach in India. He's an all-rounder, and he's saying that the rains have begun, and it remains wet for around 3 to 4 days a week, and he's realised that he needs to improve both his batting and his bowling skills. Can we please suggest some ways he can do this at home? He's also a regular fixture in the gym, so it sounds like he's fit, but he just needs to continue his batting and bowling skills at home somehow, or undercover.
I know we talked about this a million times before, but it is the rainy time in India at the moment. So I guess it's a good time to bring it back up again. So, Gareth, what do you think?
Well, there's heaps that you can do without a ball, and particularly with your batting, and that's you're doing loads of shadow work, really. And I'm a big fan of getting people standing in front of mirrors and glass that you can get reflection on, because I think it gives really good feedback to what your shapes are. And the more shadowing you can do, the better, really. And then if you can build in some visualization into that shadowing as well, so you can build in your mind's eye a game situation where you can take that technique and apply it in your visualization, in your game, in your head, then I think that's a magnificent way of practicing. And having been on tour with international players and watching games of cricket on the television or on my computer screens as analyst, I'd often see them stand up after they'd watched it or as they were watching it and start to play shots. Maybe if they were watching, I remember us being out in the West Indies and watching the likes of Jerome Thomas bowl and Fidel Edwards bowling. And Paul Collingwood would stand in my room, close his eyes and just shadow and shape shots. And in his head, all he was seeing were those guys coming in. I remember against Fidel Edwards, he'd just keep his bat lift very, very low and look to punch him, and he'd go through a repertoire of leaves and front foot punch drives and back foot punch drives to try and replicate what he was going to do against him in a game. And you can do that in the confines of your home. You don't need to have the video in front of you to be able to simulate that. You can create that in your head. So that would be the starting point for me, is getting those shapes right. And similarly, you can do that from a bowling perspective. If you've got a hallway or if you've got a room with a bit of space in it, then you can actually do, you know, your four-step drills, even though you're not bowling the ball, and just feeling your action. You can do, we've talked about it heaps on this show, if you're a spinner, you can do hand-to-hand bowling drills. If you're a seam bowler, you can be flicking the ball out of your wrist to get that upright seam position that you're looking to access a bit of lateral movement off of the deck when you get outside. So there's heaps of things you can do from a technical perspective. There's no end of things that you can do from a physical perspective that you don't need a gym for. You know, your core exercises, your lunges, your squats, all of those things can be done outside of a gym, so you can do that in the confines of a bedroom or in a hallway. You know, your body weight exercises. You can do all of those sorts of things. So there's no end to what you can do in physicality. And to me, visualization and shadowing is very, very valuable. Ideally, you want to be able to incorporate that with some hitting of balls. And if it is raining 3 or 4 days a week, then I suggest you get outside in the 2 or 3 days a week that it isn't raining and hit balls up against walls, or get somebody to do some underarm feeds and underarm drills to you, and just keep yourself ticking over like that.
Me and my brother used to do the old tennis ball one. He used to slam it against a wall with a tennis racket and I would catch it, and we'd do 10 and 10.
Yeah.
And then play a little game. Who would drop one, keeping a running score? But tennis balls are good because they pop out your hands, don't they? So you've got that soft hands, and they come quite quick and they can sting a little bit. I always think tennis ball practice is really good.
They are good, and there's a slightly different dynamic to catching them, which isn't necessarily realistic, but that can be counteracted because there is going to be rain around, obviously, in India presently, and this is what we're referring to. And tennis balls, when they get wet, actually you know, pick up some weight and pick up a bit of stability. So they're fantastic to hit wet tennis balls at each other and get catching and get hitting with those. Makes it more realistic without, you know, if you get one wrong, without breaking a finger. So I would use the rain as a training aid, really. And certainly the wetnesses will be on the floors, on the roads and in the pathways and down the sides of alleyways where you're going to be hitting balls. I'd use that to an advantage. Equally as well, you can get the ball really skidding off. So if somebody's throwing, giving you throwdowns, you can get a nice skiddy surface to hit off of as well, with those tennis balls coming off of that. So, you know, as opposed to seeing the rain as a reason why not to practice, how can you incorporate the rain and use it positively to enhance your practice? That would be a really good challenge and something I'd like to hear back from our listeners in India and how they've done that.
Yeah, practicing diving is quite good fun when it's a wet surface, yeah, as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's so many things.
Yeah. So diving for the line, or if you got an old pair of pads that you want to get that you want to get in a mess, or fielding. I'm interested in that. I'm going to take us off on a slight tangent. I'm interested in that difference between catching a tennis ball and catching a cricket ball. What's the story behind that, Gareth?
The story behind that is the way that the hand reacts. So if you put a weight into the middle of your hand, if you drop a weight into the middle of your hand, then your hand will clasp around the object, whereas a tennis ball, because A, it's light, and B, because it has a rebound capacity much more so than cricket, you often then end up grabbing and snatching at the ball, trying to anticipate the ball coming into your hand rather than letting the ball hit your hand and then your hand doing what it's designed to do, which is to close around that object. So that's the difference, which is why if you can ever use the harder tennis balls or the slightly heavier tennis balls, which mean that you don't get injuries yet you still have that weight going into your hand, or the example I've just given, which is getting your tennis balls wet, which in India at the moment shouldn't be too much of an issue, then you increase that weight, which means that the mechanics of a hand actually works in the way that it's designed, rather than you trying to anticipate a ball hitting your hand because you know it's going to bounce out.
Can you still get those tennis balls that are surrounded in leather, that so they look like a cricket ball until you actually pick it up and you see that it's a tennis ball with it? The grey nickels,
yeah, you can get those, but you can also get the heavier tennis ball. So instead of it becoming a leather component, which obviously increases cost, you can get a heavier tennis ball, which is slightly harder, which is slightly heavier, yet isn't extortionate in terms of you know, the cost of it as well. And we use them a lot. So we use them a lot on squash courts in the winter as well. And we were doing our catching drills, you know, and I hit these harder tennis balls at people because A, it means that you can increase the volume because you're not going to get the bruises, but there's enough weight behind them that somebody's going to be catching with a proper hand mechanics rather than trying to grasp at a ball and do something which, when a cricket ball comes at you, if you start doing that, then you're in the land of broken fingers.
This week's soapbox is brought to you by the coach. You've got 1 minute, coach, go for it.
I was talking to someone who had got one of our ebooks in the week. He said to me, this ebook that I've got is brilliant, thanks very much, but what do I need to do now? So he'd read it, and then he got to the point where he didn't think what to do next. So I think that's something which is a problem for a lot of people, is that you have a lot of information available to you these days, but the really important thing is not how much information that you can have, because you can almost have an unlimited amount of information. You just keep gathering information forever. It's acting on that information rather than just reading the book and going, that was great, what do I need to do next? You need to find a way to incorporate that information into action and do something. And even if you think that what you're doing is wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't do anything at all. Even if you're conflicted about what you should do, you should always act rather than just gather information. That's the end of the show for this week. A couple of things that we need to do before we head off back into the internet, and that's to decide on our competition winner for the week. We had Aaron's question about pitches and deciding whether it's about a bowl, and we had VJ's question about training indoors in the rain. So Gareth, which one did you prefer?
I like the indoors in the rain one. I thought that was a good robust conversation about options available, and hopefully, you know, listeners out there, and I know we've got numbers of huge numbers of listeners in India. Hopefully you can take some of that on and build that into their practice programs whilst the rains are there.
Yeah, and rain is of course not just isolated to India, so especially if you live in this country at the moment, it seems to never stop raining. But that's a complaint for another time. So if somebody wants to get in touch with us to win that prize and get their question answered, Berners, what would they need to do?
We've got a telephone still. It's 020-88-167-691. Or we've got an email address. You can email us on this one. It's coach@pitchvision.com.
You can get us through Twitter, PV Cricket Coach, and you can also get us on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. If you want to subscribe to the show and listen every week, you can do so in iTunes. Just do a search for Pitch Vision Academy in iTunes, and if you don't want to use iTunes, you can find the feed on pitchvision.com/academy. Just click on the podcast link in the green bar at the top. So this week I was this is how tragic I am. This week I was reading a coaching book from the Mumbai Cricket Association, which they put available on their website. So I downloaded, had a little read of it. And it's the kind of thing I do in my spare time. I know it's sad, but that's what I do. And they had some shots in there, and all the usual shots were there. And then they had one called the Marillier shot. And I thought, I've never heard of that one before. I'm going to have to find out what that is. So I looked up a little bit more, and it was a dill scoop before Dilshan. And someone had decided, in the explanation of it, it was the shot that's played down over the batsman's shoulder, trying to get it over the wicketkeeper's head, as made famous by Zimbabwean cricketer Doug Marillier. And I thought, that's probably a slight overstatement to say that he made that famous. He may have been one of the first to play it, but I think Dilshan is the one who made it famous. What do you think, guys?
Dilshan absolutely turned it on its head, I suppose. But I first came across that shot because Doug actually played some games for Somerset Seconds a few years ago. I think he played two games for us and got 100 in one game. And then the whole of his repertoire came out, which included that. And so that was the first time that I'd seen it. And I remember it made a bit of a sort of queue around the club about, you know, everybody started to practice it after that. But obviously on a global scale, you know, Dilshan, and I think it was 2009 T20, wasn't it? That he really came onto the scene with that one. I can remember him playing at Trent Bridge and flicking balls up over the top of wicketkeepers stuff like that. So, the Marillia shot doesn't have quite the same the same ring to it, is it?
No, he's not the same standard of batsman. I'm sure he'd be the first to admit it.
He's a top chap though, Dougie. I enjoyed his company when he played for us, and I know he's drifted into coaching and umpiring and all sorts. He's obviously a cricket tragic that doesn't want to stay out of the game, so good luck to him in whatever he's doing now.
And apparently Moeen Khan used to play it as well in the late 90s.
Yeah, Moeen Khan used to do everything, though, didn't he? Let's be honest about that one. Yeah, listen to him.
But I've not found any footage of that. I found it on YouTube, the Murillo shot, so he definitely did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, he did. You know, I can vouch for that.
So that's our tail ender for this week, and that wraps up the show as well. So until next week, we'll see you next time. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Bonus.
Cheers.
Cheers.